Bill Cosby symbolized a societal shift challenging stereotypical portrayals of African Americans in popular culture.
Who's in trouble now?
Theodore.
Oh, good, because I thought it was me.
Take a look at this. Four D's. You better handle it, because if I handle it, he's going to smile and say, no problem, and I'll have to kill him.
So you want me to kill him for you?
Right.
Can I have something to eat before I kill him?
Cliff.
Yeah, I'll be crueler. On an empty stomach.
Lucille Ball, clumsy post-war housewife, dreamt of something better, her own chance at showbiz fame.
There's Cary Grant. Wait. It is.
Will you sit down and stop gawking? You're acting like a tourist.
I have a feeling we've run into a whole nest of them.
As Sarah Jessica Parker proved to our nation's women that they could have it all.
Big and I stayed in bed all morning, which gave us just enough time for coffee and some last-minute details.
Tina Fey served as a reminder that it was harder than it looked.
This message is for the co-op board, I guess. This is the number you gave me. I hope it's not fake. Does everyone know that you're a bunch of liars, or should I tell them myself? Because I know a lot of people.
These actors and the writers who wrote the shows they starred in are the architects of arguably one of the most beloved American pastime, the situation comedy. Obsessively watched and critically ignored, the genre, contends Saul Austerlitz in his new book, Sitcom, is, quote, a capsule version of the 20th century arts, realism, giving way to modernism, and then to postmodernism, all between the hours of 8 and 10 p.m. on weeknights. Saul Austerlitz's new book is Sitcom, A History in 24 Episodes, From I Love Lucy to Community. It's a pleasure to welcome Saul Austerlitz to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
What got you thinking about this, and especially in such a specific way of looking at not only specific shows, but specific episodes as well?
Well, my previous book, Another Fine Mess, was a history of American film comedy. And I realized in trying to tell that story that there was a counterpart that I was consistently leaving out by virtue of the focus of that book, which was television. You know, film and television are so intertwined and symbiotic in so many ways. They're really like squabbling siblings. So I realized that there was a pretty fascinating other story to be told, and that got me on the road towards sitcom. And once I was thinking about how I might be able to best go about it, I realized that television shows, and sitcoms in particular, are defined by their episodes. They're defined by particular episodes that we come to love and talk about and think about and, you know, chuckle over. Also, the traditional sitcom, you know, the 1950s, 1960s sitcom of the Leave It to Beaver era, are focused around their individual episodes in the sense that each episode is really a recreation of a kind of platonic ideal of what the sitcom should be, that there's a problem, and the problem is solved, and everything goes back to exactly the way as it had been.
Well, Beaver, I'm glad you decided to tell us the truth.
And so thinking about that, I realized that it might be an interesting way to structure this book to focus on particular episodes of shows as a way of beginning to tell the story of these shows in general, and then of the eras in which those shows might be found.
What makes a sitcom a sitcom?
Well, I wanted to have as open a definition as possible. And, you know, some people will definitely disagree with me. But my feeling was the sitcom in its traditional form has a number of factors that make it a sitcom. It's a half hour long. It often has a domestic setting. It concerns a family. It concerns parents and children. It usually has a laugh track. And obviously, over time, that's changed quite a bit. There are some shows that I think of as being sitcoms or as containing some DNA of the sitcom that are an hour long. There are shows that don't have laugh tracks. Most sitcoms today don't have laugh tracks. And there are definitely also shows that mingle comedy and drama in ways that older shows might have thought to be inappropriate. And I think each of those trends can be seen moving forward, that the sitcom is moving away from the more traditional bells and whistles that kind of scream sitcom to us, and yet the same kind of interest in storytelling and in finding a flexible worlds that can be revisited over and over remain.
Are you tired, rundown, listless? Do you poop out at parties? Are you unpopular? The answer to all your problems is in this little bottle. Vitamin contains vitamins, meat, vegetables, and minerals. Yes, with Vitamita Vegemin, you can spoon your way to health.
You start with I Love Lucy, and the Lucy does a TV commercial episode. And given your definition, that loose definition that you just gave, this really was one of the first shows, I Love Lucy, to fit that mold, right?
Absolutely. What was interesting for me was that I had been working on the assumption that television shows and sitcoms would get more self-aware and self-revelatory over time. But what I'd found instead was that shows like I Love Lucy and The Honeymooners are already thinking about the role of television in people's lives and kind of poking fun at the tropes of TV from the very beginning. So it's not so much that TV becomes more self-aware, but rather that it gains more self-respect. It understands that it's okay to take itself seriously and to think of itself as a form in its own right that has its own history, its own traditions, and its own styles.
I like that there are shows in here that you would very much expect there to be, and then there are shows that you wouldn't expect, maybe, on the face of it, and yet it's wonderful to be reminded of them. One of them, very early on in the book, being the Phil Silvers show.
Yes, that was a show that I felt strongly about. It's one that has not been as well remembered as I Love Lucy or The Honeymooners. It's not, you know, you can't find it on TV generally. It's not as easily available on DVD. But in a lot of ways, it provides the template for the more acerbic kind of series that have really succeeded in the last 15 or 20 years. Shows like Seinfeld and Curb Your Enthusiasm and Louie. You know, the character that Phil Silvers plays, Sergeant Bilko, is not a nice guy. It's not a show about warm and fuzzy feelings. It's a show about a guy who wants to get the upper hand on everyone constantly and is perfectly happy to embarrass and humiliate them to make that happen. And sometimes it reverberates on himself, but there's something incredibly appealing about someone who's such a jerk, you know, being one of the earliest sitcom stars.
Mm. And you mentioned Seinfeld, you mentioned Curb Your Enthusiasm, and even Arrested Development, I guess, would fall into that category. Not the nicest people that they're portraying.
Oh, absolutely.
Did you enjoy your meal, Mom? You drank it fast enough.
Not as much as you enjoyed yours.
You want your belt to buckle, not your chair.
I'm curious as to how you chose the individual episodes as well as the shows themselves. So I assume the shows came first and then finding the episodes that would best typify what you were trying to say.
Yeah, I began with trying to select which shows would best be able to tell the story as a whole and which shows were most necessary, you know, such that if I left them out, it would leave a gaping hole. And there were some shows that I thought at the start that I would include and that ultimately felt to me like there just wasn't quite enough to say about them or there was too much overlap with another chapter. So, for example, I had thought about including South Park and Soap. And both of those shows, while I have a lot of respect for them, there wasn't quite enough there for me to really turn over an entire chapter to them. So once I'd selected the shows that I was going to write about, it was then a process of looking at the individual episodes and trying to figure out which one was either so iconic that I couldn't possibly write about anything else. Like, I felt like there was no way I could write about the Mary Tyler Moore Show and not have it be about Chuckles, Bites the Dust.
It's so sad. Funerals always come too late.
I'm not sure I understand that, Georgia.
Well, I mean, we take people for granted while they're with us. Then when we're gone, we wish we'd been nicer to them. So we dress in black and cry our eyes out? Why don't we ever think to do that while they're still with us?
Good question.
I wish I were nice to the Chuckles when I had the chance. I kind of look down on them, you know, being a clown and all. I was prejudiced against him just because his skin was different colors than mine.
And with other shows, it was more about tunneling in and trying to figure out which episode best expressed what the show was about. And it was variable. You know, I felt with The Cosby Show, like the pilot episode was the one that did the best job of conveying what the show would be. And with others, for example, with Seinfeld, I felt like the self-reflexivity of the show, the way that it was aware of itself, was best reflected in one of the episodes in which Jerry and George try to pitch a show that sounds a lot like Seinfeld to a bunch of NBC executives.
This should be the show. This is the show.
What?
Yes. Just talk.
Yeah, right.
No, I'm really serious. I think that's a good idea.
Just talking? Well, what's the show about?
It's about nothing.
No story?
No, forget the story.
You gotta have a story.
Who says you gotta have a story? Remember when we were waiting for that table in that Chinese restaurant that time? That could be a TV show.
And who's on the show? Who are the characters?
I could be a character.
You?
Yeah, you base a character on me.
So on the show, there's a character named George Costanza?
Yeah. What, there's something wrong with that? I'm a character. People are always saying to me, you know, you're quite a character.
And who else is on the show?
Elaine could be a character. Kramer.
Now he's a character.
And then going to Curb Your Enthusiasm, where that episode is about Seinfeld, and again bringing that all into a perfect circle.
Exactly. I mean, Curb Your Enthusiasm goes even further than Seinfeld in that self-awareness, such that you have an entire season that's essentially devoted to attempting to undo the fallout or the perceived fallout from the Seinfeld finale.
I recently saw the Cosby Show pilot again and was reminded of how perfect that pilot is, because it really sets up the entire show. Some shows get better, they find their footing, and that's a show where the act was presented in that first episode and you knew exactly what you were going to get into pretty much for the next 9 seasons.
Yeah, one of the things that I like best about the Cosby pilot is that it fakes us out. It gives us this sense that we're going to see another warm and fuzzy domestic comedy about loving parents and their children. And there are a lot of ways in which The Cosby Show is that, of course. But The Cosby Pilot presents this setup where Theo, one of the Huxtable children, basically asks his parents to understand him, you know, that he doesn't want to be a white-collar professional when he grows up. He just wants to be a guy.
Son, your mother asked me to come up here and kill you.
Hey, I know.
You know what?
What you gonna say? And it's under control. So, no
problem. No problem. Right. How do you expect to get into college with grades like this?
No problem.
Huh?
See, I'm not going to college.
Damn right.
I am gonna get through high school. And then get a job like regular people.
Regular people?
Yeah, you know, work in the gas station, drive a bus, something like that.
So what you're saying is your mother and I shouldn't care if you get D's because you don't need good grades to be regular people.
Right.
Okay.
And it's kind of this very traditional, sappy sitcom moment. And then Bill Cosby completely undoes it and tells him, you know, that's the stupidest thing that I've ever heard. And that, to me, really sets up what the show is going to be, which is that Bill Cosby has created this incredibly flexible character that allows him to demolish all sorts of domestic icons that we might have gotten used to.
I have to say, in reading the book, and you just used the word sappy and made me think of this, that I was with you on every single solitary show and pretty much every single solitary episode. You got me, though, at Gilligan's Island. Make a case for Gilligan's Island.
5 passengers set sail that day for a 3-hour tour. A 3-hour tour.
I actually don't want to make a case for Gilligan's Island. I had the misfortune of having to sit through every single episode of Gilligan's Island in order to write this book. I also made my newborn son sit through it, but thankfully he wasn't too aware. It's it's not a good show. It's, I would go so far as to say it's a bad show. But the reason why I ended up including it was that I felt that it was indicative of a certain era of television. You know, it comes after the pioneers like I Love Lucy, like the Phil Silvers show. It comes before the flowering of a new style of television in the 1970s with shows like MASH and the Mary Tyler Moore Show and All in the Family. It's a bad show, but it's very much reflective of what was happening on television in the mid-1960s. And so I felt like it was important to include something like Gilligan's Island, even though it's not really all that interesting or compelling, because it was very much a product of its era and very much reflective of what television was like in that era. And if I had left it out, or if I just had skipped over that whole period, I felt like readers might not have fully taken in the fact that there was this pretty lengthy fallow period. And interestingly, also a period in which there's this incredible turmoil in American history, and, you know, incredible turmoil in current events. And yet what's happening on television is in some ways as retrograde as it's ever been.
And I think what is so stark is that this chapter comes right after the Dick Van Dyke Show, which is arguably one of the most intelligent and well-written shows ever on television.
Oh, absolutely. The Dick Van Dyke Show was another series that I was very pleased to discover. It held up so well and was so consistently entertaining. And I think that it's particularly reflective of what the sitcom had been at the beginning and still really is in a lot of ways, which is that it is a format that gives us leeway to spend quality time with a performer whose company we really enjoy. Dick Van Dyke, to me, is one of the great performers ever on television. And in a way that's very similar to Bill Cosby or Roseanne or Tina Fey or a lot of the other figures mentioned in the book, the Dick Van Dyke Show just allows us to have that space to just enjoy what he does. By contemporary standards, I think the Dick Van Dyke Show is a little bit odd. It's a domestic show and it's a work show, and it also has all sorts of musical numbers, and Dick Van Dyke does dance performances. It's a little bit of this and a little bit of that. But I think the show is extremely effective at just allowing a really talented and capable performer to do all the things that he does best.
If you don't trust me like you should,
that's no good. If you won't take my best advice,
I'm not nice. If you don't say you think that I'm okay, that isn't any way to be.
What we need is good old harmony.
You talked a moment ago about Seinfeld and Curb Your Enthusiasm, which were both shows that were very self-aware. But you also included The Larry Sanders Show and also 30 Rock, which were shows that go after television, that allow us to look at the medium itself.
Yes, I think what's particularly interesting about The Larry Sanders Show is that it emerges at roughly the same time as Seinfeld. And, you know, so for Seinfeld, this self-awareness and this poking fun at TV metaphors and tropes is kind of part of what it's doing. Whereas with The Larry Sanders Show, we're really thrown into the snake pit of Hollywood and not ever allowed to emerge. It's a show that, in contrast to what I was just describing, really forces us to spend time with a bunch of very unpleasant people. And the humor emerges from how unpleasant they are, but the show is unforgiving in a lot of ways. It never really lets up. It doesn't give us much leeway to feel sympathy for its characters, who are often suffering in a lot of ways, but they're so unrelievedly unpleasant that we're kept at a distance from them. And that sounds like a very unpleasant scenario for a television show, but The Larry Sanders Show is remarkable to me, A, in really changing the rules of what a funny show on television could be. It doesn't have a laugh track. It doesn't engage in any of those sorts of sympathetic routines that sitcoms often do. And it doesn't give us any space. It's claustrophobic in a lot of ways, but Gary Shandling, who created the show, has an incredible ability to mock not only the world that he sees around him of these sort of venal characters, but also himself.
And it also was very reflective of its time, of the late night wars and what was going on. And you could read about it in the paper and see this riff on it on Sunday night on HBO.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're wholesale ripping off all sorts of little tidbits that we may or may not remember from, you know, the Leno-Letterman wars, like
right.
Jay Leno hiding in a closet when executives were talking about his show. But it really is a 1990s artifact. I mean, going back and watching it, I was surprised how many O.J. Simpson jokes there are on the show. It's like Gary Shandling was obsessed or something.
Well, the nation was obsessed at that time, I guess.
That is true.
Arrested Development is a show that is interesting, and I'll use it as an example of one of the shows in the book that had moderate success. Many of the shows are iconic television programs. They were on for many, many seasons. They did extremely well. And Arrested Development is one of those shows that it became those two words that can be the kiss of death, which is a cult favorite.
Yeah, the interesting thing that's happened over time is that I think in a lot of ways we're in this golden age of television. You know, there are more and more shows worth watching. There's more and more excellent television today than maybe any time in the past. And yet, I think a lot of the shows that I write about from a more recent era, shows like Arrested Development or Community or Freaks and Geeks, really suffer from basically no one watching them. And some of them have long tails. You know, Freaks and Geeks and Arrested Development have really found audiences after getting canceled, you know, via DVD, via Netflix.
Right.
And Arrested Development even manages to come back. But, you know, if you crunch the numbers a bit and look at shows like The Cosby Show and Cheers and what their ratings were like, and then look at some of these shows that at least I think are comparable in terms of quality, and look at their ratings. I mean, they're infinitesimal in comparison.
We have unlimited juice? This party is going to be off the hook.
The era that once existed where, you know, everyone in America was watching the same TV show and then talking about it the next day, talking about what Cliff Huxtable or Sam Malone might have gotten up to, seems to be over.
The name of the book is Sitcom, A History in 24 Episodes from I Love Lucy to Community. The book is published by Chicago Review Press. Saul Austerlitz, thank you very much for being with us. It was a very enjoyable book, and I thank you very much for sharing with us this morning.
Thanks so much.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the title of the book, Sitcom, A History in 24 Episodes from I Love Lucy to Community, published by Chicago Review Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
Cool.